The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit SustainableSystemsFoundation.org, and thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
The following show was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. Good evening, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Today, something completely different. My guest is Dr. Esther Leslie, Professor of Political Aesthetics at Birkbeck University in London. Political aesthetics highlights the complex and ambiguous connections of aesthetics with social, cultural, and political experiences in contemporary societies. This past January, Leslie published an entry in The Stone, a New York Times column on philosophy. There she asked, "Are we the cows of the future, to be manipulated and managed like livestock?" I found the article so compelling and provocative that I immediately got in touch with her. Professor Leslie, welcome to Sustainability Now. Let's start with the question of political aesthetics. Now, I taught politics for 30 years at UC Santa Cruz, and you know, I did some work on popular culture, but never political aesthetics. So what does the field entail? And is it related to the cultural politics that bedevil the United States today? And I imagine Great Britain as well. But...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I kind of chose the title myself when I was asked to give myself a professor title. And in some ways it was a provocation because lots of people think that, you know, there's politics over here and that's, thinking about government and the state and questions of democracy or other types of rule. And then there's aesthetics, which is just this thing about sort of beauty and pleasure and enjoyment. And of course, there have been many times when art has been expressly political and politics has been artistic entertainment. Your recent president is probably a great example of that, of sort of playing politics as entertainment. So for me, I've always just been interested in where politics and aesthetics rub up against each other, you know, and sometimes that's historical questions, isn't it? It's a sort of abuse of art for political ends, be that, you know, in Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany, or in, you know, less obvious ways, the ways we might think about, you know, 19th century architecture giving us certain ideas about how a city should be. And then, you know, there's a kind of sinister story in there in that it's used as manipulation or it directs people or it tries to produce certain atmospheres and feelings. But there's also, for me, a more hopeful story, which is all sorts of experiments of bringing art into life through things like Dada and surrealism and thinking about the art that inhabits our unconscious or an accidental scattering of blossom on a street. You know, which sort of means that we're all kind of artists in our everyday life, or we all perceive in that way. So that's another kind of encounter of art in the polis, in the political realm. So I just wanted to bring these two things together to kind of annoy people in politics who, you know, think art shouldn't have anything to do with it, and to annoy people in aesthetics who think that, you know, art is something to do with things of great value and shouldn't be sort of dragged into the city realm.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you're referring to cities. Of course, there are these sort of two interesting forces. I assume you're referring to Hausmann's design of Paris as one example of politics, you know, shaping aesthetics, the design of the city. But of course, and now referring to your discussion of utopias, which we'll come back to later, you know, there's a lot of talk about greening of cities and smart cities. And there was a Google project proposed for Toronto, I think, which was supposed to basically be, you know, this kind of smart city that would manage all of the population and, you know, produce all kinds of outcomes. And then you've got the sort of opposite tendency, the sort of localist tendency, which is, you know, let's take our neighborhood and not gentrify, right, but turn it into some kind of semi-socialist commune, right, where we're producing our food. And again, there are these aesthetic streams, right? But you know, both of them are forms of management. And so how does art and culture fit into that idea of managing people?
I think those were really great examples, because that whole idea of Haussmann reinventing 19th century Paris, which is full of all these little alleyways and corners that state security can't penetrate into. And there's this whole idea that this is where conspiracies and political activity develop. So we have to wipe it all out and make the big boulevards that it should be impossible to build barricades across, you know, and it allows military vehicles to sweep through the city and show that it owns that space. And then, okay, we're thinking in the present about the smart city. Now, close to me, I live in central London. There's a new part of the city being built with Google headquarters, massive building, UK or European headquarters being built there, which is indicative of the fact this new part of the city, which is private space, in the guise of public space, but it's operated by private security guards and full of CCTVs, which there's a battle over them, but they were ones that potentially the estate wanted them to do facial recognition, which is currently illegal within Europe, but it's all sort of being discussed at this moment. So it's a smart space, which is used, you know, which in some ways is very beautiful, nice to hang out in, but is totally subjected to surveillance and security and a sort of limitation of what can happen there. So it's a sort of Haussmannization of the present. Around the corner where I live, there are efforts to do these greenings that you talk about and little allotments and make little oases in the centre of the city. And I think the difference there is that it's a self-management once you bring it back to the locality, or that's the ideal, or that is what I would like it to be. It's not a place that's overseen by all sorts of agencies who have interest in it. It's a self-managed space that people are kind of grown up enough to produce democratic communities and to work out the inevitable conflicts that arise over the usage of space, but without having to sort of outsource it to a whole set of smart cameras that are feeding all the faces back, you know, to the security guards or the police or the shops, you know, who are just wanting to monitor consumer behavior. So there's management and there's self-management, and maybe that's where a debate needs to be focused.
So are everyday objects political? You know, I, for example, iPhone versus Android phones. I mean, is there a political distinction there? And is there an aesthetic aspect to that, right? Well, not right, but.
Yeah, everyday objects are political, how they've come into being, what they do predominantly is political, how they, you know, even down to things like the shape of those objects. Are they made for the average male hand or the average female hand? Or, you know, how does their camera calibrate light? Those are all questions that are political ones, or they have, you know, there's a techno-political kind of context there. I mean, you know, I'm quite fascinated by just how much AI is present in phones, which tend not to work that brilliantly as phones anymore. They tend to be built around the camera. And but there's so much kind of aestheticization happening on the photographs that you're taking, sharpening, color enhancement, that, you know, you're really just sort of sampling a vague kind of impression of what's around you. And there's an aesthetics to that. And there's a politics to that, presumably, because that relates to the way in which we want to use those photographs to say things about our life and what we're doing and so on. But whether there's a specific politics to Android and a specific politics to iOS is kind of is another question that, I mean, and is partly the distinction is for consumers, isn't it? Is to encourage the market and to encourage fandom and, being locked into a certain set of purchases and so on. And at that point, it's kind of taken away from us. So I don't know if I'd say that there's a political distinction as such between them, although undoubtedly, you know, certain types of people are drawn to one rather than the other, and because they perceive certain kinds of meanings, political meanings behind the different types. But really, it's just consumer distinction, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, that raises also the whole issue of masks, right? What masks come to represent in terms of politics, right? And I can see there are, you know, political aesthetics around that. The reason, you know, doubt here in California, we're near Silicon Valley, and at UC Santa Cruz, Macs and iPhones are highly favored. And there's a sense in which it is an aesthetic statement. Mm-hmm. I grew up, well, I didn't grow up, but I grew old on IBM and its clones and, you know, subsequent evolution. And whenever I'm asked to use a Mac of some sort, I find I don't know how to do it because the icons and the logic differ.
Yeah.
Right. And so in some ways I'm an outlier in this area, but I think most of the world is not. But so there is this kind of interesting aesthetic politics. But as you point out, it's mostly driven by consumer desire, right? Or creating consumer desires. Yeah.
Yeah. And this goes back to how, you know, there's a very strong sense, wasn't there, in terms of, you know, IBM was the big solid rock of corporate anonymity, and then the Apple story as the rebellion against that, with the kind of design aesthetic, but also the sort of almost revolutionary sort of sense of itself. But, you know, that sort of origin myth, we're kind of far from that now, when, you know, we're talking about those things that look like toothbrush heads that you stick in your ears to listen to stuff, and this kind of, I don't know, a sleekness and impenetrableness, but it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. And I suspect, you know, the real stuff, the open source and all the other stuff is happening somewhere else, and we don't kind of have images for it if we're not part of it.
Yeah. Why don't we take a short break?
This is KSQD 90.7 on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Esther Leslie, professor of political aesthetics at Birkbeck University in London, and author of a range of works on the relationship of politics to art, culture, milk, and manufactured objects, among other things.
I discovered your work through your New York Times column last January, Are We the Cows of the Future? And you know, I reread it this morning, and it's an extraordinarily interesting and provocative piece. And it talks about, you know, about the nature of nature,
and also about this sort of growing digital management, I guess. I mean, is that correct? That's, you know, and I wonder maybe you could sort of tell us a little bit about the column. I have linked it on our website so people can read it, but, you know, what were you trying to achieve there?
Yeah, I think it was trying to alert us, if we need to be alerted, to a kind of creep of, as you say, digital management or sort of digital incorporation into our lives, you know, that it is everywhere, you know, to the extent that we also subject nature to the kind of smart technologies and AI systems that we're increasingly engaged in. So, you know, the kind of horror image of a cow wearing virtual reality goggles in a Russian farm because the farm is so bleak and horrible, so the cow doesn't produce enough milk because it's stressed, and so you stick a VR headset on it and let it believe somehow it's within sunny meadows to increase productivity. And I mean, you know, that is a real thing, okay, a test farm, you know, that's a real thing happening in our world, but its imagination seems to outbid all manner of dystopian science fiction we might read or films that we might see. And these things come along and they seem strange, weird practices, and then they're very swiftly normalized and we just incorporate them into our life. And then if you think about all the technologies we use now, it's including this platform through which we are speaking, and we were given a very rapid education, or I was anyway, and all this stuff over the last year, and now it's become second nature, as they call it, to do what 18 months ago felt like a really odd thing to do. And so it's about how quickly we attune ourselves to that, and then it becomes necessary, and it's not necessarily bad or insidious. And you know, it's not, you know, saying this, you know, getting all conspiratorial and so on. But I think it's that there was a moment in when the pandemic came, when suddenly there was disruption, interruption. And it felt as if we could look, as Mark says, with sober senses, just for a moment at where we were and what had happened and whether we might like to change some of our behaviors, but then the whole subsequent period was just rushing headlong back into all of that and redoubling our commitments to technology and smartness and tracking and everything that comes from that. So I think I was kind of addressing that really through my a current kind of obsession with cows. And out of a conviction that very often the way cows are treated is something that comes to us eventually, and then things that come to us eventually are then projected back onto cows, all sorts of things like genetic enhancements and IVF and vaccines. And so I was also working there with the speculation around a kind of pun that was prevalent at the time around herd immunity and how that relates to notions of herd mentality, as say a philosopher such as Nietzsche would call it. So, you know, to what extent were we being treated as a experimental herd, some of whom would, you know, go to the wall in this process of becoming infected. It was a policy of the UK government in the early stages, really, of the pandemic, because they didn't want to completely shut down the economy and so on.
I did have this question. Why cows? Cows represent a whole set of tropes these days. You know, they're also sort of the evil characters in terms of climate change, although it turns out, you know, cow farts are less important than many think they are. But, you know, what is it about cows?
I first started thinking about cows. I think it was about 8 years ago when I was working with Melanie Jackson, an artist, on this book that was to become Deeper in the Pyramid, which was looking at our human historical relationship to milk. While we were looking at that, all sorts of strange things happened, such as a white supremacist discourse, which expressed itself through the drinking of milk in this stupid illusion that somehow it was Europeans who carried a milk tolerance gene that made them superior to other figures, and therefore, you know, that somehow the whiteness of milk as a liquid sort of bonded with the whiteness of the white European who then goes on to become the supreme white figure. And it was all, you know, mistaken, phony science, but there is this little core at its heart, which is this sense of humans have very, very old relationships with cattle in various ways. And, you know, there are other populaces who don't tolerate milk so well in its raw form, but do tolerate it in its fermented form as yogurts and kefir and all these things. So, you know, myriad relationships to milk. And so Melanie and I were just fascinated by this long history, and of course the fact that women as mammals produce milk, and so that gives us a kind of intimacy or a bonding with animal experience. So we wanted to sort of bring that out, but then also think about how this fluid that's seemingly so natural is also the most technologized fluid that exists, that has been the most explored and still not fathomed. It's still not understood quite how, say, the breast milk of a woman can confer immunity and produce all sorts of effect in the developing baby. It's still, you know, just the complex science of milk is still not understood, but constantly investigated, so that, you know, powdered milks can be made, and then a proliferation of materials out of that, whey powders for bodybuilders, and gets used in paint strippers, and just endless kind of uses of this material, which is also, in the period we were writing about it, very politicized. I mean, it became a big signifier of Brexit and the problems with what would happen when Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland were in different political configurations, what would happen to the milk that passes multiply and the butter that passes multiply across the borders. So, you know, it's a very political substance, but also a mythical one. You know, we thought about Hercules on Hera's breast, you know, sort of being pushed off and the milk spraying and producing the Milky Way, and so many origin myths are around spilt milk. And so it was just a really rich substance to think with, and because I was working with an artist, she was also working with it, so, you know, making milk and cutting up butter and doing things with ice cream, which, you know, can look so wild. Ice cream can become, you know, anything if you color it and cast it that way. And it led me into a whole kind of rabbit hole of stuff that I'm thinking about now to do with froth and foam and sort of turbidity and the turbulent stuff, which I think are their substances, or they're almost like aesthetic descriptions for dominant forces in our turbulent and environmentally shaken up world. So, you know, I think now about lattes with their foam in relation to toxic foams that course through the streets of Hyderabad or elsewhere in the world as kind of as part of a continuum of this turbid, frothy, foamy material that in one part of the world expresses itself as the coffee that keeps us going, that, you know, keeps us smart and on top of things, and at the other end of the world is the horrific byproduct of poorly managed industrial systems of waste disposal.
In the piece, you talk about nature playing a familiar role as a haven to guarantee human well-being. And then you say utopian thinking is full of this fantasy. And, you know, and I think that's something worth pursuing. Okay, so how does that work?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think, you know, in part, nature, to imagine nature pure and unscathed, and that as a state we would like to bring back, you know, it's a kind of Garden of Eden
right
thinking. And I guess that, you know, there's something comforting or desirable about that, because what we otherwise look at is the plastic clogged oceans and you know, extinction, and you know, so something, you know, there's a power in that utopian thinking to imagine we can heal nature, we can bring it back to as it was. A philosopher I think about a lot, Adorno, though, I think makes a valid point when he says that fantasy is already itself, you know, it is a fantasy, or it's a corruption, because, you know, the fact is we have altered nature. You know, nature is historical. There is no pristine state that can be rewon. I mean, he talks about the moon and his extraordinary ways of saying, well, if you actually look at the moon, which would be this sort of pure pristine at the point he was writing, as yet untouched by human foot. But if you look at it closely, actually, it just looks like an industrial waste dump. You know, it's yeah. it's already yeah. constituting itself within our eyes, you know, in relation to that which represents stuff that we've produced or ruined on the earth. And nature isn't always pristine. I mean, that's another cliche, isn't it? Red in tooth and claw, and, you know, its own, that whole idea that if you don't manage forests, they just sort of strangle themselves and everything within it. So we've lived together with nature and altered it constantly. And so then you get back to those sort of questions of stewardship, don't you, and guardianship, and sort of coexisting, I suppose, rather than some sense in which it's a paradox, isn't it? We can make it better again, and in that process somehow we've also withdrawn ourselves from it, but it doesn't work like that. You know, nature is subject to history. Climate change, I suppose, is just one version of that, and history is affected by nature, you know, in a feedback loop, you know, by climate, by events, by even just by the fact that, you know, Kluge and Richter have this book, the artist and a writer, called December, which looks at every day in December through the Second World War, and they note the weather conditions. Mm-hmm. And because meteorology is also like a science that the Nazis tried to sort of forward for their military aims. And so they think about the ways in which the weather affected war. So that's sort of nature working back on history. So we have to think these things together and dialectically, I think. And utopia doesn't allow that, because it sort of cuts something off in some way and makes it pristine in some sense, or untouched by human hands.
Well, the other thing that utopia does, you know, whether it's a state of nature or sort of a technological wonderland, right, it really does bring an end to history, right? Because the vision is that things then continue in that condition, right? And I'm sitting here thinking about, a lot of this is about human nature, right? About what we call human nature, which, you know, somehow to reshape it so that we all get along and hierarchy is intact. It's a deeply sort of political or politicized sort of notion. We need to take a short break.
This is KSQD 90.7 on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Esther Leslie, professor of political aesthetics at Birkbeck University in London, and author of a range of works on the relationship of politics to art, culture, milk, and manufactured objects, among other things.
One of your books, Synthetic Worlds, addresses the origins of synthetic dyes in the 19th century Germany. Now, I have to confess, I've only read about the book. I didn't have an opportunity to read the book, but also about the relationship of those synthetic dyes to German romanticism and nature. And I think, again, that's a really fascinating connection, right? That you use technology, which is somehow connected to this political aesthetic. It raised a whole set of associations for me. So maybe you could tell us about a little bit about that history, and then about how it degraded into, you know, the German chemical industry.
I think that's a really interesting thing, that in the sort of early, 1820s or so, or maybe a little earlier, I suppose early 19th century, you've got a bunch of people who at nighttime are romantic poets like Novalis, or they're more, not quite romantic, but certainly imaginative types like Goethe, so, you know, writing his novels and his poetry, and also doing sort of botanical explorations. And by day, they run mines, silver mines, or they're working in the new science of geology, going into the earth. Novalis' actual name, birth name, is Friedrich von Hardenberg, and he discovers brown coal and how to process it. And so they're sort of going into the earth. They're writing these fairy tales, you know, about caves and jewels and riches under the earth and little gnomes and all of this. And then they're also involved in the early sciences of mining, of coal extraction. And of course, they can't see, or they can't foresee where that will end up. But one of the people I wrote about in Synthetic Worlds is a scientist called Friedrich Ferdinand Runger, who I really loved, because he would just sit in his sort of hobby laboratory at his home outside Berlin in Oranienburg, and with one hand he'd be cooking potatoes, with the other hand he's taking all these coal derivatives, coal tar, and sort of mucking about with it, seeing what will happen. And in that process of experimentation, he discovers, or he's able to make a synthetic blue dye, which then kickstarts the whole of this German chemical industry. But he's coming from a time when, if you did a PhD, you had to defend it in Latin, which he couldn't, but he could barely speak. So he gathered together some cliches in front of Hegel, because he was the professor at Berlin. So there he goes, sort of muddling his way through that. But it also, I think it's indicative of the sense in which that science is arising at a point when science and poetics are not separated. So Runger, I love so much, because he discovers this synthetic dyes that kickstarts an industry. And if you want to read a sort of crazed version of my book in fictional form, you would read Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow and think about the ways in which it all feeds into Monowitz's factory at Auschwitz and V2s and all sorts of stuff like that. But Runger's interested in it because he sees these chemicals as animated, as having self-determination. And he does these dropper experiments and invents chromatology, you know, and drops them confections of these chemicals from his dyes onto paper and observes the ways in which they separate out, because that's beautiful and because it's an indication of a kind of animate energy within chemicals and within nature. So I was fascinated by how concrete science, also with Goethe, he makes various discoveries within botany, within biology. He forwards the science of morphology. All these things that are, and also color theory, which later becomes the basis of Edwin Land's Polaroid technology. So there's these concrete scientific achievements, but they are not separated from poetic practice and from a vision of nature as this active and I suppose, you know, sensuous and self-determining realm. And then, you know, it develops and Germany doesn't have colonies like the British and the French, and they want lots of dye for their military uniforms and so on. So they put a lot of money into that dye industry, and then big science comes along, and then we get IG Farben and, you know, and everything that then feeds into, and then I suppose the kind of dominance of German science today through firms that were involved in that, like Bayer and Merck and all the others. So, you know, it goes on quite a long history, I suppose, and that original sense of the animacy of nature is lost once you can kind of cream off a certain kind of instrumentalization of the processes.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to pardon, you know, our industries, our modern industries, many of which emerged out of war, right, and military research. I mean, the very technologies we're using here were originally developed, right, for military purposes. It's something we don't really recognize. But there's also a sense in which, you know, science and technology went through this kind of phase of progress. And somewhere you do also mention something about progress. Maybe we can come back to that. But, you know, to this utopian, this technological utopia of the future, right? I mean, I grew up with that in the 1960s. I think I don't know if you were, you know, aware of that, right? And I always ask, you know, say, well, wasn't the future wonderful? But more recently, starting, oh, I don't know, in the 1980s or the 1990s, there's been a return to aestheticization of science. I mean, an interesting one. And, you know, it's apparent in all of the television shows about all of these different aspects of nature. I don't know if anyone's done that with coal mines, but you know, the sort of nature shows and cosmology and ecology, these are all have been, again, it's sort of nature as this utopian object, right? Mm-hmm. Or idealized object, right? And so, although, you know, again, this idea of the anima is really interesting, you know, and manifest, I guess, in things like Gaia, mm-hmm. Right? That, but anyway, that's just, again, that's just sort of pursuing random thoughts. Well, the thing about synthetic materials, and especially plastics, which you've also written about, is that, you know, they come from the natural, right? I mean, mm-hmm. from petroleum, which is the composed of the dead bodies of trillions of marine critters from millions of years ago, right? And yet we don't think of oil that way, right? And we certainly don't see plastic that way. It's mm-hmm. it's unnatural. And now it's out of place, you know, and I thought about Mary Douglas about stuff out of place, you know, and dirt. Mm-hmm. when I was reading what you were writing, and of course this is once it's not in our possession anymore, right? As long as we have it, it's in its place, and then you throw away your phone, right? It's out of place. So what is the natural? See, I mean, that's what I'm getting at is, you know, because we talk about natural so much, you know, how do you think about that?
I think that's kind of the hardest question, and maybe it's an unanswerable.
That's why I asked it.
Question.
Yeah,
because yeah, I've been doing this project at the moment, looking at the history of a British international chemical conglomerate called Imperial Chemical Industries (ICI), who finally kind of wound down in the 90s. I think the only bit of them left is to do with AstraZeneca and ASCO's Nobel. So they make some house paints and they make famous vaccines and pharmaceuticals. But one of the things that struck me about ICI and the site I'm looking at in the northeast of England was all these extraordinary ammonium sulfate, largely fertilizer chemicals and plastics that they were making on site, almost directly made from the wind around them, the sea, and a reserve of anhydrite that happened to be or is under the factory. So that is why the factory was built there. So, you know, all you're doing is smashing together in your great cracking towers and fractional distillation towers and so on, bits of nature, you know, and you make your fertilizers and you make your plastics, and it's just nature reworked, I guess, forced into certain kinds of bonds. There's an extraordinary film by Alain Resnais, which is just a promotional film for a French chemical company called Duchesne, I think, which takes a red polypropylene bowl and plays it all backwards through its making, backwards, 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 or its unmaking, I suppose, until it's just plankton in the sea and oil in the sea, you know. So we know there are these lines from nature into these things, but it is as if, rather than chemistry, there is this alchemical change, because things made at ICI in 1951, like the red polypropylene bowl, are still floating around the oceans, or bits of them have broken off. You know, a little plastic toy from a cereal packet was found recently, having sort of washed out, it's been bobbing around on the oceans, you know, showed up in the Arctic or somewhere as pristine as, you know, as the day it was extracted from the packet of Kellogg's cornflakes or whatever. And so there's something about, you produce a state of timelessness, or either it doesn't decay, or worse, I suppose it does decay in giving off bits of itself, that in that slow seepage of a kind of toxicity in a very slow kind of time, and it moves, you know, that whole idea that in, coming back to breast milk, you know, in the breast milk of Inuit mothers, there are loads of plastic toxic elements, you know. So it distributes itself through space, across time, in an extraordinary way that is virtually magical. So it is this kind of, it's a sort of nature become other to itself, I suppose. You know, in some way it's still nature. I don't think there's a absolute divide there, but it produces malevolent energies and results.
Yeah, and then there is this notion, things were once produced to last, and now they're produced not to last, right? And that, of course, feeds the whole system of production.
The terrifying thing, the amount of electronic consumer waste and face masks, you know, the one-use things all over the floor, endless production of stuff.
Okay, well, let's take another short break.
This is KSQD 90.7 on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Esther Leslie,
professor of political aesthetics at Birkbeck University in London, and author of a range of works on the relationship of politics to art, culture, milk, and manufactured objects, among other things.
So I also found your critique of dystopian cultural artifacts, I think especially films and novels, right, that predict and picture environmental catastrophe. And it's sort of interesting, you know, that professor at UC Berkeley, whose name right now I cannot remember, unfortunately, but talked about US narratives as being either ascensionist or declensionist, which was to say that they're either about, you know, going ever upward to these, to the city on the hill, or ever downward into hell. And so we've got these kind of two, you know, it's much easier to picture dystopias. There's this interesting sort of feature, which is that, you know, there's no hope, but you can watch it happen again, and maybe as a flaneur. And I had to bring that up, you know, although I'm not sure that's quite the case. So, you know, what are the politics of these kinds of dystopian cultural products? And how do you think about those?
There's this line from Walter Benjamin that never leaves me. He's a philosopher whose most famous essay is The Work of Art in the Age of Its Technical Reproductions. He's thinking mm-hmm. about how photography and film change our relationship to culture, to old style painting and so on. But he has this sort of epilogue to this essay he's written, and he's thinking about the fascist futurists, Marinetti and these people who wrote a manifesto, you know, praising war because of its technology, because of its, you know, effects of bombs and gas and sparks and noise, you know, and they all rush off to fight in the war and find it terribly exciting. And Benjamin says, we've become so alienated, I guess, from ourselves and from each other and from our place in the world, that all that's left to us really is to take pleasure in watching our own annihilation. And I think, I mean, there was a period which is maybe over now in terms of film, although I'm not sure where film is now. And
yeah.
Not watching Netflix and not being able to go to the cinema for more than a year. But there was a period when there were lots of eco-disaster movies. And I got particularly obsessed with The Day After Tomorrow, which is all about this massive super snowstorm that freezes up America or the whole world, but we see it from the perspective of New York mainly. And this sort of sense of what pleasure we're being offered in seeing our own, the grinding of everything to a halt. And of course, those are redemption narratives usually, you know, there's some hero who sort of sets the world to right again. I think it's been really interesting this past year because of the way the pandemic did in some way, you know, it was a huge environmental or atmospheric catastrophe in the sense that I certainly and many around me were kind of scared to breathe our air for a while, and it felt like being in an incredible disaster movie. And all of those sort of resources of kind of wandering through it as a flaneur and sort of finding a kind of sublime beauty in destruction, I think were removed, were pushed back into the home very much and confined to quarters and quarantine. Even so, I think some people did really enjoy it in a way because of the drama, because of the disruption, you know, because, you know, that there's a utopian thing within that dystopia, which is a kind of suggestion that we don't always just have to get up tomorrow and go to work in the same way as we did yesterday. You know, something global, almost universal, has happened. and sort of re-stitches or reconstitutes and reconstellates relationships around the world. So, but I mean, that's not the movies, that's real life, and, you know, the possibilities it opened up and the things that it stopped. But yeah, I think, you know, we humans are forever, we are forever thinking, how bad could it be? And would I survive it? I suppose that's kind of one of the motivations, I guess, for Hollywood movies.
Yeah, there's you know, an eschatological background to all of this, right? The saved and the damned, or the damned and the saved, right? And one gets to watch it as one of the elect or the saved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is very much the sort of the way things were presented and written during the Cold War, right? Mm-hmm. When it was nuclear war that everybody was terrified about, but the cultural products were always written from the perspective of an observer, you know, the flaneur who somehow survives this, right? And, yeah. and at some point it occurred to me that, of course, I would be vaporized in the first few seconds. There was this film, The Day After, which was released in the 1980s and created a big political uproar here, right? It was about a nuclear attack, and Kansas City was the focus. Mm-hmm. And it showed people being vaporized. I mean, it was really kind of, you know, gut-wrenching. Mm-hmm. But there was objection to it because it would weaken the sort of the character of the American people, and they would surrender to the Soviets. And I mean, you know, that sort of political aesthetic,
yeah,
sort of remains there.
I think that's a really interesting point, because it is if we're talking aesthetics, we're in the realm of the sublime.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, this kind of romantic aesthetic, which suggests that we are the observer looking on a scene of destruction that will not affect us. It may affect us emotionally, but we can contain it. We will survive, you know. And it's that sense that we can't really imagine our own death, or it's distressing to imagine it. So we use cultural strategies to imagine ourselves as the hero or the survivor.
Well, it gets us back to bubbles and bomb shelters, I guess, doesn't it? Yeah, there's a title for another article. Why do we think, look, we're running out of time, but you know, why do we think that technology can save us?
I suppose because we're always told that it can, or, you know, we're constantly being sold it, both, you know, as domestic consumers and at the grand scale, you know, the technological fix, I guess. And I guess in some ways there have been times when it has, or it certainly changed things, but there's always that contradiction within it, isn't there? Like, you know, did the washing machine free up the housewife, or did it just mean that she did more washing, or in the time that she gained, she became a worker? Or, you know, there's always contradictions, because technologies operate within prevalent social relations. But, you know, I guess we're never more so than now, when we spend, you know, so much of our time with that shiny slab in our hand that seems to be our portal to the entire world and anything we could imagine that we might want to know, see, think. The only thing it can't do, I guess, is give us real taste and smell and feel sensations. But certainly for the eyes and the ears, you know, it's utterly immersive and compelling, and yeah. And it floods our imagination, I guess. In the end, we forget how to do anything that's not technologically mediated.
Well, Esther, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This was really, for me, this was a really interesting conversation. I hope our listeners find it, you know, the same. And, you know, I look forward to seeing more of your work in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
For those of you interested in learning more about political aesthetics and Dr. Leslie's work, I've posted a number of links on the K-Squid blurb for this show. The next broadcast of Sustainability Now will be in 1 week, on Sunday, May 23rd. I'll be speaking with Dr. Suzanne Simard, Professor of Forestry and Conservation Sciences at the University of British Columbia, about the social life of trees. Her memoir, Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, has just been published by Knopf, and she's been getting a lot of airtime and interest for it. According to Simard, communication between trees happens not in the air, but deep below our feet in an incredibly dense, complex network of roots and chemical signals. She writes, in a single forest, a mother tree may be connected to hundreds of other trees. Find out what those trees in your backyard are plotting. That's next Sunday, May 23rd, right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and ksquid.org, streaming on the internet from 5 to 6 p.m. If you'd like to listen to previous broadcasts of Sustainability Now, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station. That includes Christine Barrington, who was engineer for this broadcast. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.